Hi friends, Sam Jackson Reed here, the Digital Communications Coordinator for CSW and producer of this podcast. I'm just popping in at the start of the episode to let you know a few important things. Firstly, thank you so much for listening. This is the first in a new series that we are starting called Spotlight, which we're hoping will be a powerful resource to sort of share the stories, history, and context of some of the cases and the countries that we work on. We really hope that it will serve to inform you and to inform others and raise awareness about freedom of religion or belief violations across the globe. We stand in solidarity with those who are suffering. We want their stories to be heard, and we hope that this is a useful platform for that very purpose. So what you're about to hear is part one of a two-part conversation with Mohanad and Sarah, who are going to give us the broad brushstrokes and an overview of the current conflict happening in Sudan. You may find that questions come up as you listen to this content, as you listen to this conversation. That's great. We'd love to gather any questions that you have and do a sort of special question and response episode further on down the line to really answer those questions in the fullest possible way. So the way you can do that is by going to our social media and dropping us a message. You'll find the links for all of that in the description box below, as well as a few other helpful resources, further reading on Sudan. One more thing, a small disclaimer. This episode was recorded in April of 2025, and all the information that that is discussed was accurate at the time. Obviously, things change and things shift in this arena. So there's more up-to-date information on our website, csw.org.uk. But nonetheless, this is a fascinating and often challenging conversation. So I'll hand you over to Darren and to Kiri to guide you through this first part of our conversation on Sudan, the Forgotten War.
Welcome to CSW's Free to Believe Spotlight series, where we take deep dives into religious freedom issues across the globe. I'm Darren Edwell-Palker, a pastor and president of CSW USA.
And I'm Kiri Kankwende, CSW's press and public affairs team leader. In this series, we focus on one nation, exploring its challenges, telling the human stories at its heart, and uncovering its history as we work towards a world where everyone is free to believe. This week, we're joined by Mohanad Al-Noor, a distinguished Sudanese human rights lawyer who is CSW's Sudan specialist. He has over 20 years of experience working across Sudan, including in the conflict regions of Darfur, Nuba Mountain, and Blue Nile.
We also have Sarah, CSW's Sudan officer, with over a decade's experience working on human rights issues in Africa and specializing in freedom of religion or belief in Sudan. In order to carry out her work safely, Sarah uses a pseudonym. So thank you for joining us today, Mohanad and Sarah. Sudan has been described as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Can you explain to our listeners what's happening there?
Thank you so much, Darren and Kiri. It's great to be here and share with you today about Sudan. And like you said, Sudan has been described as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. One of the reasons for that is the scale of the war and the conflict that's gone on now for 2 years. Approximately 15 million people have been displaced in Sudan or displaced from their homes. And around 4 million of those have actually been displaced into neighboring countries, South Sudan, Uganda, Egypt, and Chad have borne the brunt of this crisis, humanitarian crisis that's unfolding in the country.
Yes, as Sarah rightly said, and it is continuing, we are talking today while almost 300 or more than 300 families have been displaced from North Darfur. Over the last 3 days, more than 300 have been killed by the rapid support forces, the RSF. Horrific news that women were raped. Many people were they burned their tents. This is the biggest camp in the country, and now we are expecting this militia to go towards Al-Fashir, the last biggest city in the region of Darfur. Therefore, it's the biggest IDBs camp in the country, and therefore region is quite a big country. It's like France. So imagine how big it is, and I think the serious step have to be taken to protect the civilians in Darfur and all over the country.
To understand the conflict, Sarah, can you give us an overview of the key players that are causing this conflict to spiral?
Yeah, the war that started about 2 years ago, the two parties to the conflict really are the Rapid Support Forces. And for those of you who might know a bit about Sudan, they were referred to as the Janjaweed. They were originally created as a militia by the Bashir government. And there is very clear evidence that they were involved in the genocide in Darfur, predominantly from broadly Arab tribes that were fighting against those of African or from African tribes in the state. And they have become part of the security infrastructure for Sudan. And about 2 years ago, the National Army, the Sudanese Armed Forces, and the RSF had made an agreement to essentially merge. But the two leaders of the groups, General Hemeti, who leads the RSF, and General Al-Burhan, who leads the Sudan Armed Forces, after working together collaboratively over sort of 2 or 3 years, they then had this falling out and the war started. For those who perhaps know Sudan or who are familiar with the country has known conflict in nearly every part of the geographical area. You'll know that South Sudan split and became its own independent country because of conflicts that had sort of cycled through in Sudan. But this was the first time that the war arrived and really started in Khartoum, in the capital city. And so you can imagine the addition to this for the humanitarian impact this had. Normally the wars have happened in the peripheries. People have been able to run and seek refuge in the capital. But on this occasion, the war started in sort of in the center, so to speak, and has pushed people out and has had absolutely devastating consequences, as Mohamed has described, for civilians seeking safety. Women have been targeted. And those who've been displaced in the country also have been displaced more than once. It's that you seek refuge in one town, one city, and the war arrives, then you're forced to flee again, and you're forced to flee again. And that's part of the challenge that exacerbates the conditions that people are having to navigate right now.
Thanks, Sarah. Just to recap, the two main groups here that are causing the conflict, the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, and the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces. For our listeners, we'll hear those acronyms throughout the conversation as we talk, but those are the two main players here.
Yeah, and the two main players in 2021, they led a coup against the transitional government. The leader of the RSF, Abdel Fattah Burhan, he was still the president of the Sovereignty Council, while the leader of the Rapid Support Forces was his deputy. So it is a war between the president and his deputy. And then it spread all over the country. And when we say the war started in Khartoum, this is significant because Khartoum is not only the capital. Khartoum, almost a quarter of the nation live in Khartoum or used to live in Khartoum. Khartoum was like 10 million, while the population in Sudan is like 40 million something. And most of these people have been displaced from Nuba Mountain, from Blue Nile, from South Kordofan, and other parts of the country, as rightly said. So these people have been subjected to displacement again and again and again.
These numbers are staggering. You've mentioned 15 million people displaced, 300 families. But despite the sheer scale of the war, it's also known as the Forgotten War. Why isn't anyone doing anything to stop this?
Well, we feel like because we are in Africa, where many think this is what's supposed to happen, so that's fine. We have been completely forgotten. The number is almost 150,000 have been killed so far. And the scale of destruction is unseen in most of the cities. Still, we feel like no one cares and no one makes anything to support Sudanese people. And as much as they're getting what they need from Sudan, that's fine. Sudan produces 80% of Arabic gum, and this has never stopped. It still continues. Sudan produces significant gold, and this is still continues. And it is strange to say that still the trade between the RSF and SAF still continues as normal. And many countries is still getting what they need from Sudan. The trade flows smoothly from a part controlled by SAF to RSF and from RSF to SAF, while civilian who pay the cost of this war. So we feel like the war just for the world forgotten about us. But I think this is a strategic mistake, because Sudan location is really important. I mean, for the trade, the Red Sea is very important for the security in the region, because if we think about what's going on in Palestine, in Gaza, for example, and in Yemen, Russia want to have a military base in Red Sea. Iran also want to have a military base in Red Sea. The US want to have a military base in but they do nothing to stop this war. And I think Sudan, if this war continues, this will have impact on other countries, other neighboring countries, like in South Sudan, the war, it is about to start again. In Chad, the situation is very fragile. And if Al-Fashir, RSF took control of Al-Fashir, which means the whole region of Darfur, this will have implication on Chad and other countries. So I think the international community must pay attention to what's going on in Sudan to have stability in the region.
You've mentioned quite a few, I mean, areas, their security, as you just said, gold, trade, Arabic gum. First of all, what is Arabic gum? Can you explain that briefly? But also, which countries are we talking about that are also involved in this conflict?
Our Arabic gum, and also, as I said, Sudan produces 80% of it. Arabic gum is very important in so many products, from M&S cola to medicines. So it is something really the world needs. And gold, UAE now is in the top list of the countries that export gold, while it has no gold at all. So most of this gold is coming from Sudan through the rapid support forces. And that's why the UAE support RSF by supplying weapons. And I think this is very important. And now Sudan has a case before the ICJ, even though we know this is a very thin case and it won't stand. But the fact is, the UAE support Sudan and get lots of gold. Strangely, it's still a trade between the government, all the quote unquote, between the army and UAE, it still continues as normal in gold as well. One of the other countries that support following the war in Sudan, Egypt, who stands with the army, Iran as well, standing with the army, Russia, support both SAF and RSF, and also Russia interested in Sudan gold, Turkey, for example. So there is so many international actors involving in this war, and this beyond Sudanese capacity. And that's why the international community must take serious step to stop these countries from intervening in Sudan. It's important to say there is a resolution, the UN Security Resolution, that arm embargo in Darfur. Still, these countries managed to send women to like UAE to Darfur through Chad. And there is other UN resolution to stop the siege in El-Fashir, which is about to fall. So there are so many resolutions, but no one respects this resolution. And I think this is what the international community must do if they really want to stop this war.
Another part of that picture of the different interests on the war is, as Mohanad mentioned earlier, this is a war between two generals. This isn't a political movement that has the support of 20 million Sudanese that rose up and tried to change the system as such, or this isn't an uprising against sort of an establishment as such. These are two powerful men who hold all the guns, who have access to all this trade, who are engaging, as we can see very effectively and clearly, in international trade and some aspects of diplomacy as well. And the civilians, the Sudanese people, are the ones who are suffering, but also seemingly voiceless in these big, big dialogues and in these big discussions.
Thank you for mentioning that. I wanted to ask, because in these contexts of conflict, and we're talking about countries and regions and continents that are vying for power and position, we can often lose sight of the human toll that it takes. So can you explain and help us understand what life is like for civilians trying to live through this conflict as they are caught in the crosshairs of this?
Well, we should say Sudanese people are really brave, and they always show that they are really willing to do anything to protect their country. Now in this war, the humanitarian situation is a really disaster. Famine was declared in 5 areas of the country, while it's about to be declared in May in more parts of the country. Darfur, for example, is one of these on these areas. It's still people trying their best. Those who fled their cities were housed by others in other cities. With some exceptions, of course, there is some people who are not welcomed by many, like Christians, for example, which is a minority in Sudan. So they are facing lots of difficulties in northern states. They have been denied fundamental rights like worshipping, like work, only because they are from a specific region like Nuba Mountain, or that because they are Christians. Some of them were forced to take their cross if they want to walk on the streets. So there is some difficulties, but I would say it's still the generosity of Sudanese people in this war really was really significant, and many, many families were housed by just the people of Sudan. But the situation is really, really difficult and beyond Sudanese people capacity. The Sudanese in diaspora, they are doing their best to send what they could to their families there to support them, which is really great. But the gap that the U.S. pause left is significant. The gap that many humanitarian aid left is significant. It is really strange that in the middle of this crisis, the largest crisis, humanitarian crisis in the world, countries like the U.S. step back instead of increasing their support. So this is really disappointing for lots of Sudanese people.
Yeah, the impact of U.S. aid cannot be understated. And it's, as those who follow the news, it's not just in the U.S. We've also seen commitments on aid being pulled back in the UK and in other countries. And this is, it's frustrating. It's really worrying because you know the impact that this is going to have is always going to be on the most vulnerable. As Mohanad has said and has described, there's famine declarations in so many states in Sudan. Jazeera State used to be known as the breadbasket of the country. Food was being exported from Sudan to Middle Eastern countries before this war had started. And so the real impact that people are seeing, that humanitarian organizations are speaking about, is that people are dying from famine, from hunger, because they cannot get the access to food that they need because of the war. But also people are dying in conflict zones, in conflict areas. Humanitarian workers are being targeted. Medical professionals are being targeted by both parties in this conflict. But the aid, as Mahanad had said, and it's very difficult for international organizations to operate in Sudan because of the bureaucracy that is put in place by both the SAF, but also the RSF in their controlled areas. And one of the things that was really impactful and dynamic in terms of US aid was that the US aid had found a way to navigate the reporting requirements to be able to get funding directly to sort of resistance committees, the emergency kitchens that were Sudanese-led initiatives where people were coming together, were making food and providing essential assistance to those who are vulnerable. You know, some people can't leave their homes because they're disabled, but the emergency committees, these emergency kitchens would be able to come together and make meals and assist those who are living in their neighborhoods, in the areas that they're in, even under sort of siege conditions, as we've seen in Al-Fasha. And so these changes at the kind of international level sometimes don't mean anything. Sometimes they're just headlines, but in reality on the ground, these are, you know, elderly people who are no longer able to get their one meal a day from emergency kitchens that were sort of putting food together. And that has exacerbated the situation.
Thank you for sharing that, Sarah, because often in the midst of these conversations, we can get lost in the scale of what's happening. And part of our purpose in talking about these issues is to raise the awareness of what it's like for everyday people going through this that might not be able to have their voice heard. And part of our conversation is to raise the awareness so that we can hear and be moved to action on their behalf.
Yeah, and on top of that, the emergency rooms, the local kitchens, and the resistance committees, those who are the de facto government, those who are the people who are running the country, feeding the people, providing treatments. But they have also been targeted by both SAF and RSF. So in many areas, when the SAF recaptures some cities, some of those were beheaded because those who were the protesters who ousted Bashir, and this like kind of revenge in RSF-controlled area also, 2 weeks ago, at least, or 3 weeks ago, before the RSF retreat out of Khartoum, 50 people were killed by the RSF. All of these who emergency room response to people's need. So on top of the humanitarian situation, there's lots of crimes committed against civilians in both areas. The forced marriage, the sexual gender-based violence, like forced marriage, rape, gang rape, there's a horrific reports from so many organizations. Just last 2 days ago, the Amnesty International released a report telling horrific stories like women have been raped while they're breastfeeding their kids. They have been teared out to be raped. These like 15 women were put together and they were raped for months and months. Hot water, like they banned them. Lots of horrific story. UNICEF had also published a report a couple of months ago that children as young as 1 year old were raped. So the scale of the crimes in this war is really, really horrific. Not talk about the destruction. This everywhere have been the destruction everywhere. So Khartoum now is like a ghost city, which is the capital. As that. And the Sarah mentioned about the Jazeera state, the bread basket. So thousands have been displaced, and the coming few months, not it's not years, it will be a disaster because the Yazidi state produce most of food needs in Sudan. So it's not over. Even if the war stops today, people will face lots of implications.
I would just like to add that I think we've become so used to documenting these violations, and some of the reports that we're reading now are just unimaginable. And, you know, Sudan is a very conservative country, very conservative society. And one of the things that worries us when we're sort of doing our work of documenting and sort of working out trends is that the types of violations we're having reported are so serious. But we know that it's just the tip of the iceberg. We know that there are countless other stories of people who are unable to share or who can't be reached. And so to hear some of these violations in the way they're being documented, they represent just a drop in what else is being going on, because there is a restrictions in communications, and the ability for people to hear exactly what is happening is has been restricted as a part of the war strategy by the armed groups and the army. And I think again, going back to sort of the humanitarian needs and meeting the humanitarian needs, some of what international aid does is it resources hospitals, it resources clinicians and doctors and midwives to go in and to support, not just with the immediate aid and need, but also psychosocial support that is so necessary when people have lived through such severe, serious trauma.
Listening to you both, you've quite rightly used the language of crimes, violations. Some of what we're hearing sound like they amount to some of the most grave crimes that can be committed under international law before we even get to the impact on the people who have to go through this. I wanted to ask about one area of crimes that are going on in the midst of this crisis, violations of freedom of religion or belief. Mohamed, you hinted at this when you mentioned Christians from the Nuba Mountains, but I'm sure after 3 years of constant displacement, there are many other groups also affected by four violations. Can you share a little bit more that aspect?
Of course, Sudan is a country very well known of its violations of freedom of religion and belief for decades. So before the 2019, for 30 decades, the briefest regime, the Islamic Brotherhood regime, had been discriminated against Christians for decades. After the revolution, during the transitional government, there was a hope. There was some improvement. Some laws were amended. Some of the confiscated churches building were back to their owners. But as soon as the coup in 2021 happened, we see the same practice had been happening during the Bashir time are back. But still, after the war, it's something different. Because the day that the war broke out in 15th of April 2023, the same week, almost most of the churches in Khartoum have been looted, destroyed. Many priests have been forced to convert to Islam. And this by the RSF. So we have lots of reports about how the RSF intimidated these Christians, looted their churches and their buildings, while the army intentionally bombed lots of churches in Khartoum, like the evangelical church in Bahri and Omdurman, the biggest church in Sudan, and in other places. In Bashir state, for example, the RSF set a church on fire. They took or confiscated another church or church building, used it as a military base. Similarly, in Khartoum, many churches had been used as a military basis after everyone was forced out. So it was obvious this is not just like accident. These are systematic, widespread attack, and it continues. Just last week, even though RSF has not left most of Khartoum, but in this area is still controlled by RSF. We had a report last week that they attacked a church in Omdurman, and they physically harassed and intimidated those who were in the church and looted the church. So this is from the belligerents themselves. I also recall here a whole village in Jazeera State called Mubi Athoura. The whole village was forced to convert to Islam by the RSF. And those who managed to escape the village were arrested by the army for being affiliated with the RSF. So those who managed to flee, they're also subjected to harassment, arrest, and intimidation by the RSF. And we saw that in many areas, like in Shendi, for example, in North Sudan, tens of Christians were arrested for weeks, if not months, had been charged with heavy crimes, like undermining the constitution, being affiliated with the militia, blah, blah, blah. But from the community itself, which is something very new to some extent. In the past, most of the violations used to come from the authority. Now, even the community, and this is the implication of the continuation of the violations for quite a long time and for the war as well. So in some areas in North Sudan, Christians were not accepted, like other IDPs, for being Christians. So they were forced to leave another area. And there was a camp in North Sudan in Adbara area, Adbara area, in Blue Nile and White Nile State. River Nile State. After they being forced to leave the city, they had a camp outside the city, just in the desert, just tent, where there's nothing, literally nothing, and the authority provide them with no support. But they've been ordered to evacuate this place, and all these tents have been destroyed. So this is just an example of how those have been treated during the war. Some were accused, falsely accused of theft. I've been sent to court, some kind of intimidation. Some were refused the right to work. In other areas, like in Halfa, between Egypt and Sudan, IDBs in the shelter, Christian IDBs in the shelter, were not allowed to worship last Christmas. They were not allowed. They sought permission from the authority to celebrate Christmas, but the authority refused them, while others had the full right to enjoy their religious celebration, like Eid, for example, for Muslims, like Ramadan, which was good, but to discriminate against those who live in the same shelter because of the religion, this is really disappointing. So as you said, there is a crisis within the crisis, and this is something we should highlight.
Thank you so much for listening to part one of our conversation on Sudan, the Forgotten War. We'll be back next week with part two of our conversation with Mohamed and Sarah. But for now, if you have any questions, please do reach out to us on social media so we can gather them up for a special question and response episode later on down the line. CSW is a Christian human rights organization advocating for freedom of religion or belief. As Christians, we stand with everyone facing injustice because of their religion or belief. Our work, including this podcast, exists because of the generosity of our supporters, just like you. If you're interested in finding out more or making a donation, go to csw.org.uk. You can also help us grow this work by sharing with your friends or leaving a 5-star review in whichever podcast catcher you're currently listening on. The CSW Free to Believe Spotlight Series is hosted by Darren Adwalpoker and Kiri Kankwende. It's produced by Samuel Jackson Reed, and our theme music is Coriolis by Sizgi, made possible thanks to artlist.io. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.